everyone. It is my great pleasure to welcome you to the 30th anniversary of the March of Dimes Agnes Higgins Award. I'm Dr. Jennifer House. I'm the national president of the March of Dimes, and we are so delighted to have you join us today as we celebrate Agnes Higgins' legacy in maternal and fetal nutrition, and celebrate the outstanding achievements of this year's distinguished recipient, Dr. David Barker. I want to especially acknowledge the two chairs of our co-sponsoring APHA sections, Dr. Sybil Kranz, who's chair of the Food and Nutrition section, and Ms. Joanne Fisher, who's chair of the Maternal and Child Health section. Thank you for all your work to put this session together. And I want to especially welcome each and every member of the audience here today. I know we have some past Agnes Higgins Award recipients. We certainly have some wonderful National March of Dimes medical and scientific leaders who've joined us today. We have APHA leadership as well, and the wonderful volunteers and staff from our Colorado chapter. Welcome. We're so proud to have you as part of the audience today. And I'd like to especially acknowledge Janice Bierman and Mary Lavin, who are the March of Dimes staff responsible for putting the entire session together. Janice, Mary. We greatly appreciate the leadership of APHA in our collaborative efforts to improve human health, and we're very, very honored to have with us this afternoon for this 30th anniversary celebration the Executive Director of the American Public Health Association, Dr. Georges Benjamin, who's going to share a few remarks with you. Dr. Benjamin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. And good evening. And we're absolutely glad to be here. As you know, this is the 30th anniversary of this award, which has been given in conjunction with the APHA annual meeting since the award was started by the March of Dimes in 1980. It is co-sponsored by our Food and Nutrition section and our Maternal and Child Health sections. Now, you know, APHA has had a range of collaborative works with the March of Dimes over the years. And Jennifer, we obviously appreciate the ongoing work we've done together and really look forward to our work in the future. It's very clear that it's in all of our interests for us to work together. You know, if we're really serious about improving the health of our public, therefore we're gonna have to improve the health of all, starting from preconception. And the March of Dimes is the organization that has really, in many ways, led the national charge to that effort. So we're not only celebrating this award tonight, but of course, we're also celebrating the partnership that APHA and the March of Dimes has had all these years. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the program. Thank you.
I think this certainly is a time when all of us in who are dedicated to improving health outcomes must really take stock and find ways to work together. I think the enactment of health reform earlier this year certainly opens opportunities to transform public health like never before, but I think certainly the election results over the last several days are a strong indication to all of us that we're going to have to especially figure out ways to work together to decide what's really important and to put our collective will to driving those programs forward in a successful way. Our founder of the March of Dimes, President Franklin Roosevelt, was very keen on the public's health, and he was very keen to find ways to stimulate political will and public support for health programs. And one of his very famous quotes was, Public health is more than a local responsibility. Disease knows nothing about town lines, nor do bacteria undertake to inquire about local jurisdictions. And I think those words ring true equally today. So involving more people in public health from awareness to action is our very best hope for influencing positive change and decision making. And to recognize, of course, I think all of us appreciate the fact that in many cases, change begins with one individual, one thoughtful and courageous individual. One discovery at a time enables us to make change. One new preventive measure at a time enables us to make change and enables us really to transform the world. This award today is named after one such person. For those of you who have any collective memory or recollection of Aggie Higgins, you will recall she was very salty. She said exactly what she thought. She did not mince words. She was not afraid to speak truth to power. She was not overwhelmed by a lot of fancy titles. She just did her work in the Montreal dispensary, making sure that women, and especially poor women, understood the importance of nutrition during their pregnancy. And we thought in honor of the 30th anniversary of this award today that we would share with you all just a few minutes, a very, very short video clip so that you can see Agnes for your very own self. So if we could just roll that video, please.
Babies she lovingly referred to as blue ribbon babies. In 1948, Aggie was hired by the Montreal Diet Dispensary. She transformed the dispensary into an organization known throughout the world for its dedication to helping women give birth to healthy babies.
Aggie Higgins was a true nutrition pioneer, and the March of Dimes understood immediately how important her work was. So that's why we funded teams of healthcare professionals who traveled up to Montreal to study with Aggie Higgins so they could learn from her and then share what they learned with their colleagues back in the States.
Aggie encouraged her counselors to develop relationships with the women they served, to connect with women in a way that would change their lives forever. Aggie also stressed the importance of helping women understand that having a healthy baby depended largely on the mother's nutritional intake during pregnancy. These beliefs were the cornerstones for the Higgins Method, a prenatal counseling program Aggie pioneered that stressed nutrition and food supplementation.
We all know the disadvantaged mothers give birth to disadvantaged children. Now the question is, could we break the poverty cycle by taking an undernourished, disadvantaged mother and so improving her nutritional status during pregnancy that the fetus would have optimal and normal growth and development?
In 1980, the March of Dimes recognized Aggie's innovative spirit by creating the Agnes Higgins Award.
This award was very proudly created to honor Agnes Higgins for her innovation and lifelong commitment to the cause of maternal nutrition, and to celebrate the work of those who followed in her footsteps. Previous recipients include some of the most distinguished nutritionists, educators, and research scientists in the world. And they really embody Aggie's spirit and carry her important work forward.
Each year, the March of Dimes Agnes Higgins Award is presented to a person who embodies Agnes's pioneering spirit, a person who has made a significant impact on improving the health of mothers and their babies, or as Aggie would say, on making every baby a blue ribbon baby.
Quite an honor roll, quite an honor roll of stars in maternal and fetal nutrition. I'm going to invite another public health leader to join Dr. Benjamin and myself on the stage. If our March of Dimes National Trustee, Dr. Jose Cordero, could please come forward. Dr. Cordero is known to many of you. He's currently the Dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Puerto Rico. He served for 26 years in the U.S. Public Health Service, and he was the first director of the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at the CDC. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jose Cordero.
Thank you, Jennifer. Watching the life story of Agnes Higgins, we are reminded of the power of the individual as Dr. House mentioned. But gathered here at APHA, we also find another call to action, the need to transform one-to-one counseling to widespread public health advances. Take, for example, folic acid. Some of the several micronutrients that are critical building blocks for healthier birth outcomes. For many years, we encourage women to eat foods and take vitamins to contain folic acid. But progress was slow. We needed a more widespread public health solution, and we found it in the fortification of the nation's grain supply. I am proud to say that the March of Dimes was a key leader in the calling on FDA for this important change, and that the result has been impressive, a 27% decrease in neural tube defects. That is the power of public health. Counseling one a woman to eat a healthy diet is a powerful public health intervention and personal intervention. Teaching others to reach out to the community of women, as Agnes Higgins did, is even more powerful. Finding ways to make health benefits freely and easily available to all is really best of all. Of course, all good public health interventions begin with knowledge, and we depend on funders like March of Dimes and researchers like our RD, Dr. Barker, to bring forward the science and solutions that can improve people's lives. So let's turn now to the presentation of the 30th Annual Agnes Higgins Award. Dr. House?
Thank you, Dr. Cordero. Thank you very much. So this brings us to the man of the hour, Dr. David Barker. You heard Aggie Higgins say that that babies were programmed at birth through their mother's nutrition, and I think that she, in some ways, was channeling Dr. Barker in her statements. Dr. David Barker is a physician, a professor of clinical epidemiology at the University of Southampton, United Kingdom, and professor in the Department of Medicine at the Oregon State Health and Science University. He proved what Agnes Higgins believed, that good nutrition before birth is critical for a healthy life. He and his research team dared to look beyond conventional wisdom, which suggested that chronic disease was primarily a function of adult lifestyle, to discover a direct relationship between a mother's nutrition and the health of her children as adults. Establishing this link between maternal fetal nutrition and chronic disease later in life, diseases such as coronary heart disease, diabetes, obesity, certain cancers, was revolutionary in our understanding and in our advocacy for ensuring access to quality prenatal care. The fetal origins hypothesis was called heretical in 1986 after its publication in Lancet by Dr. Barker. But today, the Barker hypothesis has inspired our understanding of how true disease prevention begins before birth. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the stage Dr. David Barker. Dr. Barker, on behalf of the March of Dimes, volunteers, and board of directors, and in honor of your outstanding academic achievements in the field of maternal and fetal nutrition, we very proudly present you, in the company of a wonderful, wonderful group of colleagues, with this Agnes Higgins Award on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of its establishment. Congratulations. Dr. Barker is going to present a very, very special lecture for you all, and I'm going to take his award and put it in the very careful care of his wife, Jan, and I'm also going to take his very special check and put that in her care as well. We will look forward to your lecture, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Well, it's a great honor to receive this award. And I thank the March of Dimes and their colleagues for it. I'm going to talk for 45 minutes. I've been told if I talk for longer, something frightful will happen. Along the lines that you won't get a drink at the end of it. Now, here is the map of coronary heart disease death in the USA. And it's the map that proves coronary heart disease isn't genetic, which we all knew anyway, but the red areas, which have the highest rates, have a huge heterogeneity of population and clearly answers to the fivefold variation across the counties of this great land will not come from considering heredity. The stroke map of the United States is quite similar, and there's this constellation of states with high stroke mortality in South Carolina and the contiguous states. And we have a good clue from there. We know that you have to be born in the stroke belt to be part of the stroke belt. And if you retire to South Carolina, you're not increasing your risk at all if you come from outside the stroke belt. So, this is the American Heart Association's report on coronary heart disease, pointing out that the highest rates are in West Virginia, followed by Kentucky, and that it's poorer people who are more at risk than wealthier people, and poorly educated people are more at risk than better educated. And this is a huge paradox, because all are agreed that coronary heart disease came into the West as we got more affluent. It wasn't there 300 years ago. Now it's the commonest cause of death. Something's happened, and it's happened more to poorer people than wealthy people. Now, this is what the New York Times wrote. The explanation would come from differences in cultural norms, poverty rates, and other social factors, and not environmental causes. And that is interesting at three levels. Firstly, it doesn't mean anything. And secondly, there's a tone about that. It says, look, down there in West Virginia and Kentucky, they flunk out of high school, they sit around, they get overweight, they don't exercise, they smoke, and by, their lives are brought to a premature and no doubt well-deserved end. That has a ring about it. I live in America, and I hear that being said, and I certainly hear that being said at home in Britain. The third reason that is interesting is because you can't say that if you really know what's going on. If I showed you the map of pellagra in the US 60 years ago, I wouldn't say something like, I'm sorry that it's moved forward itself. I wouldn't say something like that. So this says, nobody knows what the map of coronary heart disease death in America really means. Now I go backwards and forwards between two countries because we have the same problem in Britain. And the red areas are the areas with a lot of coronary heart disease deaths, and the green areas are the areas with less. It's a very big problem for us. If every area on that map was deep green, the extension of life would be greater than you could achieve by the abolition of cancer. So we are exercised about this map, and it's easier to think about it than it is in America because we're a much smaller country and people tend to stay where they're born. And so you can say, well, here we are in the Midlands. See that green area there? What are they doing that the people in the red area on either side of them are not doing, or vice versa? And the answer is they're not doing anything. Their lives are the same. There isn't anything people in the green areas do that people in the red areas don't. And a huge amount of money has been spent on that. What that map is about is not what are the people doing. It's where did they come from? Their origins. I don't mean their genetic origins. I mean, where did their mother grow up? Where did their mother's mother grow up? And that is what that map's about. And the map is heterogeneous. I'm trying to get this thing to work. We've had a lot of success. To be honest, without any success at all. But there we go. These places are very different historically. Heavy industry, poor agricultural land, cotton industry, wool industry, coal mining, poor agricultural land, potteries. What they have in common is that they were terrible places for girls and young women. Well, why might that be? Well, it's complex, but known. Here is a cotton town, Preston. And before the year 1800, that was a nice country town with a few shops and some nice houses. And then the mills got built. And the mills selectively employed women. And it all started to fall apart. Because the women had to go to the mills every day, they lived in crowded housing all around the mills. Their children, their daughters, grew up with mothers who were away during the day. Didn't cook when they came back, they were exhausted. The houses were overcrowded and dank, they didn't see the sunlight. And every day they basically lived on bread and tea and little else. So the cotton industry is one of the forces that created a deep red area. Now there's a problem to what I've said, because London is here, deep green. Okay, now let's just figure this out, because that is a picture of London children in 1912. And that doesn't look a very nice place to grow up. That is the London that Dickens wrote about. So what's going on? Well, this is a description at the time of how these children lived. Their life is the life of savages, with vicissitudes of extreme hardship and occasional excess. Their food is of the coarsest description, and their only luxury is drink. As some wit remarked, it's like traveling on British Airways. So here is the answer. This is the whole map of England and Wales. And up here are the red areas, and down here are the deep green areas. And what coronary heart disease is plotted against is neonatal mortality in a time period around the time the people dying of heart disease were born. Now, this is loaded with information. It says, okay, so here we are in the green areas. clearly green areas, red areas, beg your pardon, red areas were bad for babies. A lot of babies died in the first month after they were born. Now, the reason in those days babies died in the first month after birth was that their mothers had poor physique and health and nutrition. That was very extensively investigated at the time, and a lot's known about it. So the message here says, the red areas are characterized by having women with poor physique and nutrition. Therefore, a lot more of their babies died in the neonatal period. And this is London, the London boroughs. If this had been mortality from 1 month to 1 year after birth, London would be up here. But London was a good place to be in the womb, albeit a terrible place to be born into. And the reason is that the young women in the surrounding agricultural land, which is the best agricultural land in our country, they grew up very well nourished. And when they were 16, 17, 18, they wanted money. There was no money in the villages. They came into London in huge migrations. And London renewed itself through the 18th and 19th century by large numbers of very healthy young men and women who came in to make money. So that's why London was a good place to be in the womb, because the wombs grew up in the best agricultural land. The other thing about this, the message, which really is the message I want to give to overriding everything else, is so now we're saying, look, the explanation for coronary heart disease now goes right back to babies, right? But the explanation for the babies is not what their mothers ate in pregnancy. It's the whole life of the mother. So to understand the map, you've got to go back 90 years. You've got to go back to the birth of the people now getting coronary heart disease and then to their mother's early life as well. So maps, our map, is not about what are those people in the red areas doing? What are those people in West Virginia not doing, doing? It's all their own fault anyway. That's not at all how it is. The maps are displaying the legacy of previous generations. So, having concluded that people who did less well in the womb and had lower birth weights had more coronary heart disease, we had to check this out in individuals. And this is the early study in Hertfordshire, 15,000 men and women whose birth weights were recorded at the time. They're now in their later lives, and those who were 6 pounds rather than 8 pounds or 9 pounds have had more coronary heart disease and had shorter lives because of it. And it's not about being smaller because you were born earlier, it's about being small because you didn't grow. And if you look at how they were when they were 1 year of age, this is just the weight of a baby, weighed in cottages and houses 60, 70 years ago, weighed by a nurse in a little portable weight thing. One weight is predicting coronary heart disease as well as serum cholesterol does. And it's a very crude measure of a baby. You don't just summarize a baby by how much of the baby there is. There are more interesting things to know. So this is the power of these early predictions. And they've been shown in children born in that beautiful hospital in Mysore, and in children born in that beautiful hospital in Beijing. So what's going on? Well, the essence of the matter is that all those babies could have looked very different had their experience in the womb, their nutritional experience, been different. They would have been bigger, smaller, different shapes, and that affects their organs for life. It's a process called programming. And I didn't know until just now that Agnes Higgins had actually used that word. I've never claimed to invent programming. I know people were thinking about it before I did. And it's interesting that she used it. This is what it's about. It's about malnutrition and other adverse environmental exposures during development, altering the expression of genes and programming the body's structures and functions for life. Adverse exposures also slow growth. And it's important to understand that although every day we hear about genes, and very tiresome it is, genes are not Stalinist dictators. Just because you've got a gene, it doesn't mean it's going to do anything. Most genes do nothing. And what the ones that do is contingent on other genes and on the environment. So that is the fetal origins hypothesis, that this clutch of diseases originate because the baby is very plastic, because the human baby senses its mother. Even as the egg, the fertilized egg goes down the fallopian tube, it is reading the mother's a nutritional state and it's allocating stem cells according to what it reads. Long, long before a woman knows she is pregnant, her baby has read her and made major dispositions, such as how much am I going to invest in my placenta? That decision is made very early, on day 8. So the plasticity of the baby is important, obviously. All living things are plastic. They have to be. In your garden, if you had a plant that grew to a certain height, irrespective of the soil you put it in, it'd be some plant. It's not how it works. And babies aren't just told to be 7 pounds, 9 pounds, 10 pounds by some gene. That would be ridiculous. This nation would be full of dead mothers if that was how it worked. The baby and the mother have a dialogue. The baby reads the mother. Sometimes the signaling doesn't work too well, but it's a dialogue. And anyone who knows anything about implantation, by which the placenta is formed, know that it's a very delicate dialogue that goes on. There's a lot of talking. Well, anybody can have a theory, and an illustrious British Earl wrote, well, I think we all agree with him. I certainly do. And I've got 8 children. So, in a nutshell, here's where we are. That little baby on the right is thin. 7-pound baby boy, born in Southampton, but he's thin. And he's thin because he didn't grow muscle. It's not that he's thin because he hasn't got any fat, it's muscle. If you rub your hand along the thigh of such a baby, you feel the bone. So babies, even 7-pound babies, have to trade off certain tissues and functions to protect the brain. The human baby has a huge brain, which it has to protect. And in fetal development, there's a hierarchy of organs. Some organs are unimportant to the fetus. Why do you need a lung? Your mother's the lung. Why do you need a kidney? Because your mother's the kidney. And why do you need muscle? There isn't anywhere much to go. So babies trade off things. One of the most famous living Americans looked like that when he was born. And he wrote it in his autobiography. If you read Bill Clinton's autobiography, he gives you his length and he gives you his weight, and you can calculate that he was a lot thinner than the baby I've just shown you. I'm sorry the talk's moving on by itself. Right? This is a new phenomenon in my experience. So why is it bad to be small at birth, to be thin at birth? Well, in essence, we now know that the baby will have less capacity in certain tissues like kidneys, like muscle. It will have altered the way it handles food to a more frugal usage of it, which in life after birth is called insulin resistance. And the unique hormonal profile, which we all have, was established before we were born. Our responses to stress, our sex hormones. And in this room, some people will have 3 times the number of functioning units in their kidney as other people. And that was because at 34 weeks, a decision was made according to the amount of nutrition the fetus had had, how big he or she was, a certain amount of nephrons developed. During development, the body tries to be frugal. It has much to do, and there's no point in having more nephrons than you need. And so according to the size you were on your 34th week, then that is how many nephrons you have. And that's important for your blood pressure when you get to 50, 60, 70. So I want to talk a little bit about the growth of children, and then I want to talk about the nourishment of babies. This is a chart taken from a study of 20,000 people who were born in Finland before the Second War, and whose lives have been very closely documented. Finland got very concerned about the high death rate of its children, and they set up clinics, free clinics in Helsinki in the 1920s, and almost all children were brought to them. And they had very detailed birth records, so we know how big the babies were at birth and how big they grew through childhood. Now, there are three lines on this graph, and they are three groups of people now aged nearly 70 on average. There's a group of people who have normal blood pressure. And then there's two lines describing two groups who went of children, boys and girls, who went on to get disease. On a chart like this, which is just describes Z scores for weight, most children will grow horizontally. Little boys and girls remain as little boys and girls between birth and 11, and big boys and girls remain as big boys and girls. And the children who went on to get chronic diseases grew differently to other children. It wasn't that you could identify them at one particular moment in time, but they had a different growth trajectory. And this is one of the things we're going to have to wrestle with. And the green line is the interesting line. These are the people who went on to get coronary heart disease. And when they were born, they were small, which we knew anyway. And then after the age of two, they started to gain weight rapidly. It's called compensatory weight gain. We know a lot about it in animals, less about it in humans, in fact, very little about it in humans. But clearly, part of the story of coronary heart disease is that boys and girls whose growth is held back in the womb, and therefore during the year or so after birth, they, once free from their mother, they have a drive to catch up. And that catch up has costs. And farmers never force the growth of domestic animals as fast as to grow as fast as they could. If you take turkeys and say, well, Christmas is coming on, I better force these things along, you end up with turkeys that haven't got immune systems and they die. So farmers know about compensatory growth. We know very little about it in humans, although one of the good things that is happening now is that there is an interest in it. There's no doubt at all that compensatory growth is a major determinant of how long people live. That's now in press. Before leaving compensatory growth, I just want to show you this. This is these Finnish people. This is the percent who needed treatment for high blood pressure. Down here, a group of whom only 4% in their later lives had to worry about their blood pressure. Up here, there's a group in whom 64% had to worry about their blood pressure. Who are they? They're defined by how much they weighed at birth and how much they weigh today, in fifths of weight. So the best place to be was a nice big baby with currently a small body. And the worst place to be was to be in a small baby with a big body. If you're a small baby, you have fewer nephrons. We know that for sure. If you have fewer nephrons, but you have to service a bigger body, then there are problems, and it leads to premature nephron death. But the overall takeaway from that is, by far, the strongest predictor of high blood pressure ever published, I mean, by miles, is the combination of birth weight and current body size. So, helpfully, the NIH, the NICHD, has recognized that for coronary heart disease, the number one cause of death among adult men and women is more closely related to low birth weight than to known behavioral risk factors. Now, that's just words. And whether the NICHD will be able to do the walking bit remains to be seen. But at least the talking's been done, and that's a very helpful document. And it is talking about poor transgenerational maternal health history, which is exactly the place I think we should all be. So here's a problem, a big one. The associations between early growth and later disease extend across the whole range of fetal and infant growth. So we've now got to take on that a normal healthy mother and her normal healthy baby are having a friendly dialogue, but how much food goes to the baby is critical in determining the baby's long-term health. See, I think when all this began, one could have thought that babies who are 5.5 pounds or less will do badly in their later lives, but everybody else is okay. I mean, obstetricians conduct their affairs. If you're 6 pounds, 7 pounds, 8 pounds, you're alive, you're not misformed, it's a triumph. But it isn't. That's just not how the world works. So we've got to figure out how babies are nourished. Well, they're nourished by what the mother eats in pregnancy, although that is not the central source of nutrition. It would be far too dangerous for any mammal to depend on the mother's daily diet for its source of food in the womb. And they don't. There are mammals who don't eat at all during pregnancy. Bears hibernate. Here we are in Denver. A bear mates and goes to sleep and then wakes up, and its cubs are not only born but suckled. So diet does matter, but the real ability, the real nourishment of a baby is from the nutrients stored in the mother's body and from the mother's ability to refashion food, and that ability is learned or not learned by a woman when she is an infant. So if a girl child has an adverse early experience, she will be less able to break down proteins into their constituents and then reform them, and that will deprive her baby in due course. And I'm going to talk about the placenta a little bit, because the placenta's ability to transport, to do stuff, is a very important part of the story about which far too little is known. When you think how many lectures you may have gone to on breastfeeding, and then you think how many you went to on the placenta, and then you think, well, look, breastfeeding is your second attachment to your mother, the breast. It's the placenta that brought you into this world. And amazingly few people know much about it. I just wanted to show this slide really to make a point. I don't know how many people in the room know that for the first 3 months of your life, you didn't encounter your mother's blood. You didn't just get conceived, go down into the womb, penetrate the mother's womb, and then her blood bathed you and you were nourished for the next 9 months. For the first 3 months of her life, a baby is nourished by the uterine glands that a woman has and which were laid down when she herself was a fetus. So that is one of the known ways in which fetal experience of a girl child plays down to the next generation. So this little family was starving in Holland in 1944, and their children, the children who were in the womb at that time, today have problems. They have more heart disease, they have more diabetes. They don't feel well, a lot of them. And that is what you'd expect from the experience of having your mother starving. But actually the babies grew well. And the ability of your baby to grow is not dependent on the mother's diet in pregnancy very much. And millions of pounds have been spent trying to show that if you do something to a mother when she's pregnant, she'll have a bigger baby, and she won't. And that is because it's the mother's body that calls the shots on the growth of the baby, not the mother's diet. Putting food into mother is a good intended thing, but that doesn't mean the baby gets any. It may or may not. So that, I'm sorry to show you this, but drinks will be served in 10 minutes and you'll recover. We all had one of these. It's life. Now, we are starting to learn all kinds of things about the placenta. First of all, the human placenta, it's been known for a long time, is different. We humans go deeper into our mother's uterus than monkeys or any other mammal. And monkeys don't miscarry much. Human beings miscarry a lot. And what that says is, ooh, this early formation of the placenta is a dangerous time, and it often goes wrong. We now have absolutely clear evidence that there are boy placentas and girl placentas, and they're different. And boys try not to invest in placentation because they want to grow. And girls invest in placentation. Boys don't want to put food in the larder. They just want to eat it and run. So the growth of boys and girls is very different. And the strategies they have are different. And in that lies, no doubt, answers to important things about the differing health of boys and girls and the differing lifespan. Another thing that we now know is that looks like kind of one tissue, but actually it's very heterogeneous, and tissue along the length of the placenta has different functions to tissue along the breadth, and that's something we need to understand better. So here is a group of 7,000 babies born in a little city, beautiful place in Saudi Arabia, which has had for many years very good obstetric services. And this is just the weight of the baby and the weight of the placenta. And it's really a beautiful thing that Saleh Al-Wassail has produced and published, because it says what we all know. It says bigger babies generally have bigger placentas. But the interest is that a baby that weighs 3 pounds can grow on the end of a placenta that weighs less than 400 grams, or some require 800 grams. Now, when a man and a woman decide to start a pregnancy, the general idea is to have a baby, not a placenta. So what you're hoping is to have lots of baby and not have to expend too much on the placenta. That is called efficient. But clearly it often isn't efficient, and this is an important bit of the story. Here's a group of men and women aged 50. This is their blood pressures at that age. This is how big they were at birth, and this is how big the placenta was in terms of weight. The best place to be is here, a nice big baby, not much placenta. But that's a terrible place to be. And those people will not live long lives. And in fact, I think pretty much everybody, since we did this study 20 years ago, everybody in that cell is now dead. And they just produce rather little baby on the end of a lot of placenta. And they got hypertension and heart disease and died. Down here, though, you've got big babies, mother very pleased, but they expended a lot on the placenta. And actually, it's better if those people had been smaller babies. So, put it in English, if you showed me a baby, I could tell you something about its likely future. But if you show me a baby and its placenta, I can tell you a whole lot more. And if you show me the mother's measurements of the mother's body and measurements of the placenta, I almost don't need the baby. Because, I mean, you would for other reasons, but not for my predictions, because the information is in the mother's body, that is the mother's lifetime nutrition, and the placenta, which is the result of this tight dialogue between mummy and baby. So that is where we are with this. The human placenta can compensate if the mother gets undernourished, and it expands its surface, and you get a big placenta in relation to the baby. But this has costs. These early things that children and placentas before birth have to do, this compensatory activity following a setback, is a brilliant thing to do. It carries the child through to be able to reproduce, but thereafter there are heavy costs in terms of health. I need to tell you one more thing and then I'll stop. This is the human, the female pelvis. And in the old days, in Finland, three measurements were made on every woman who was pregnant with catheters. They measured the side-to-side width of the pelvis, and they measured the front-to-back. And they were trying to assess whether the baby could be born in the normal way. Why? Because in those days, rickets was common. And it's an amazing bit of programming that if a little infant girl doesn't get enough vitamin D, when she starts to stand, her pelvis flattens. This is pushed back to the spine. This is the pubic bone being pushed back to the spine. Now, although the little girl grows up, she never loses the shape of the flat pelvis. There's some memory that nobody knows anything about. So that even if she's in a road accident and her pelvis is shattered, it'll grow back flat. And obstetricians knew this, so they tried to anticipate disastrous labors. And they measured these measurements. Now, rickets is caused by vitamin D and other forms of malnutrition just after birth. And at that time, a girl child is learning her protein nutrition. Breast milk doesn't contain much protein, but once you wean a child, he or she has to learn how to break down the food, break down the protein, and refashion it. And if you feed an infant rice only every day, it won't learn such a good repertory of tricks as if you fed it properly. So, having told you that much, this is how the mother's pelvic conjugate diameter, flat pelvis, not flat pelvis, this is their children. This is nearly 100 years later. These mothers, mean age 30, got rickets when they were one, or just before. They grow up, they get pregnant, they have children, their children grow up, get old, get stroke, get hypertension. So that is what we're talking about. It is about the lifetime nutrition of girls and young women and its effect on the health of the next generation. So this is the conclusion from what I've just shown you, that I really said this, that the mother's poor protein metabolism prejudices the nutrition and growth of the next generation. And this leads, in the next generation, to disease. So what I've tried to chart out is summarized by this, that it is the nutrition of girls and young women that determines the lifespan of the next generation. I don't know if anybody in this room saw Time magazine last month, but to me it's encouraging. You may or may not like the picture, but it is saying the new science of fetal origins. That's definitely helpful to have general recognition of the fact that there is now a science. It's not called a theory anymore, it's science. We've got to figure some things out. It's pretty amazing that nobody's ever really thought much, with a few very honorable exceptions, about how the normal placenta works. Last December, I had pretty much limitless money from a private donor to organize a meeting in Cambridge, England, on the normal human placenta. And I sat with my colleagues in Oregon, and when we got to 20 names from anywhere in the world, we were pretty much done. Now, if we'd been having a conference on disease of the placenta, we could have had thousands of people. But that's not how it is. So it's this new science needs to start figuring these things out. There's an awful lot to be figured out. But we don't know nothing. And we certainly don't need to just sit on our hands and wait until somebody clever figures out the placenta, because there is it is quite evident that there are two issues, and one of them we know a lot about. We're not very good at it, but a lot is known about how do you get decent food into the mouths of girls and young women. The next bit is how do you make sure it gets to baby. We know very little about, and we need to get on with that. I think there's two, there's a philosophic and a commercial and then a conclusion. I like this. This is Edmund Burke, who's saying that society is a partnership between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born. That's pretty much how I see it. This is the commercial. There is a book setting out what I've set out today, and there's a website. That's the commercial bit. This is the important commercial. If these things interest you, next September, my friend and colleague Susan Bagby, who is here, is organizing this meeting to the Seventh World Congress on the Development Origins of Health and Disease. You can see why I go to Portland, Oregon. It's just a lovely place. And please make a note of these dates and come and join us. Let me end with the map that I started with. So that is not a map of misbehavior among middle-class Americans. That is not what it is. It is a legacy. It is the legacy of the conditions that young girls and young women in some places had to endure. And it has complex origins, just as it does in England, but broadly we know what it's about. We know that in New England there were cotton mills where conditions were every bit as bad as those in Lancashire. We just know a lot about that. After all, Lowell, who founded Harvard, went to the Lancashire cotton mills to see the machinery, which he then copied and set up. So we know in principle what this map is a legacy of. The worry is that A, places in our countries which have had a difficult past and are historically poor cannot make it all just go away and get better within a decade or two. It won't work. Glasgow will continue to be the Scottish capital of coronary heart disease for the next 50 years, despite the fact it's rebuilt itself. The good news is that if you get it right now for the present generation of girl children, then you get it right for 100 years. And a legacy of people in this room is that the map of coronary heart disease and other diseases in the US in the next 100 years is being written today, and we can influence it for better or worse. Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, I'm told that there's a minute or two for questions. I can give you a general answer to any question that you may wish to ask. It is, I don't know. So little is known about much of what I talk about. Thank you.
Can you speak to us about implications of diets for children today in many parts of the world where there is undernutrition?
Sure.
Chronic undernutrition. The mothers were chronically malnourished, or grandmothers, or great grandmothers.
Mm. Well, you're kind of asking me to Well, there's two sides to that. There's two forms of malnutrition in the world. There's too little food and too much of the wrong food. And in places like, say, Mexico, one is going away and the other is moving in. And clearly, we haven't figured that out. We don't know how you move a country from too little food, stunted babies, to nice, tall, muscular, strong children. What seems to happen is that the children get shunted into the wrong turn and end up short and fat. And you know, anybody who could figure that out would do a huge service. So I'm going to be in India next week, and I go there a lot. There's a big trial of preconceptual supplementation. Women in a slum in Mumbai, not far from where that film was shot, Slumdog Millionaire, they receive 5 days a week a supplement which is given to them by a nurse on a one-to-one basis. And we have great hopes for that, because that is biologically correct, the thing to do. We all know that starting in the middle of pregnancy is far too late. So many important dispositions have been made by the baby. So the results of that trial will come out next year, and we can hold our breath. But don't you feel that is moving in the right direction? We can't wait until women become pregnant to do stuff. It's too late. And no farmer in America would just let animals get pregnant and then put it any way they want. We are very casual about reproduction. It's fun, but we're casual.
Two more questions.
Sure. Well, there are people in this room who know far more about it than me, one down there. So I just know. So surprisingly, protein is not, there's not a lot of protein in breast milk, and there must be some reason for that. What breast milk does have is high saturated fat and cholesterol. And when you readjust your ideas and say, oh, cholesterol can't be bad, saturated fat can't be bad, because if it is, why did my mummy try to poison me when I was born? So that's not how it is. You've got to learn how to handle cholesterol, and if you don't, you have high cholesterol, and that leads to heart disease. But it's not because you wander down to a burger bar. That is not the driver on cholesterol. It's early life. Sorry, sir, you were...
David, I think the reason that your phenomenal work is still
a hypothesis. Am I about to hear something bad?
Is that it doesn't explain why throughout history, generally speaking, for example, what's now called the developing world, mothers ate frugal diets and chronic disease, nevertheless, was uncommon or almost unknown.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not a single way.
No.
The work you've done is phenomenally important. It's a double way.
Mm-hmm.
It's to do with
yes.
being the smaller first, but energy overfed on infant formula and on energy dense diets.
Yep.
Which isn't just a phenomenon of the rich world, it's now a global phenomenon. I think it's very important.
Mm. Okay. I think that's the point's well taken. Yes, I mean, if you think of a race, at any one point there are two groups of people who are running fastest. One is the guy who's right front, and he's just a good guy, and it's all going well for him. The other is the guy who's fallen behind and is trying to catch up. Those are the two fastest runners. And we're talking about the people who fall behind and then catch up. And I quite agree that if, when I'm in Mumbai next week, I will see children living in drain pipes who are fat. They're not very fat, and Indian people tend to accumulate fat readily. But it is a good point. Of course, it doesn't apply to stroke. Stroke is an Eastern disease. The highest rates of stroke are in China and Japan, and stroke has declined year by year for the past 50 years in America. So some diseases are single whammies, but coronary heart disease isn't, I agree. Yeah. I think we got.
So we're going to adjourn for a wonderful reception with beverages and wonderful food, some of which is more wonderful in Dr. Barker's view than other types of this food. But he will be there and available, because I see a lot of hands up for questions. He will be there and available for dialogue with you. But I wanted to take this moment to thank Dr. Barker for his wonderful lecture, for his brilliant insights, for his legacy and his contributions to maternal and child health. And we are presenting him for this 30th anniversary with March of Dimes cufflinks. This requires a French cuff. So I hope he has a few shirts like that. But let's all join our hands together and thank Dr. Barker. Thank you all, sir.